Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Michael Zander, and I'm chairing this evening's discussion rather than debate. It's not a debate because, as we'll find, both our speakers are more or less on the same side. I think it's more of an exploration of a new and very exciting possibility, which has been under discussion in this country now for 25 or so years, and is coming to fruition in the Human Rights Bill, which is presently before Parliament, is about to finish its House of Lords stages tomorrow, and will then proceed on to the House of Commons. Just a word of background. The debate about whether we should or should not incorporate the European Convention was kicked off, I think, effectively in this country by Sir Leslie Scarman, as he then was, now Lord Scarman, in his Hamlin lectures, when he, in 1974, suggested that if there had been a Bill of Rights in Northern Ireland, or available for Northern Ireland, maybe the IRA would not have needed to take up the gun and the bullet and the bomb to remedy their grievances. And that started a debate which then had all sorts of repercussions in the following years, with all sorts of groups lining up for and lining up against the idea of a domestic UK Bill of Rights, bringing the European Convention into the UK so that it was available in the United Kingdom courts. Both the major political parties were absolutely against it. The Conservatives remained absolutely against it, and I think up to the present day are unhappy about it. The Labour Party suddenly and miraculously changed its mind. In 1993, John Smith gave a speech in Church House in Westminster in which he nailed his colours and the Labour Party's colours to the mast of incorporation of the European Convention. That was the turning point, that speech on March the 1st, 1993, because as soon as one of the great parties was associated with the campaign had some political hope, and now that hope is coming to fruition. Our speakers tonight are firstly Lord Williams of Mostyn, who is an eminent barrister who has worked for years at the bar and relatively recently come to the House of Lords. He is Minister of State, he is Under Secretary of State, I beg his pardon, at the Home Office in the House of Lords. He is a former chairman of the bar and a doubter defender of civil liberties causes, a very appropriate person to be speaking for the government on this topic. And he will open, and he will speak for approximately a quarter of an hour. John Wadham, who is the Director of Liberty, which is one of the key organizations in the field of civil liberties, I would say the lead organization, formerly known as the National Council for Civil Liberties, that has played a valiant part in this campaign. They were not originally, at the very beginnings of the campaign, committed to it. There were a number of years when they were unhappy about the idea, and then they were one of the important groups that led to the change of mind of the Labour Party. And he will speak again for 10, 15 minutes. There'll then be a full opportunity, or a substantial opportunity, for the audience to express any views or to put any questions. And I've asked our two speakers to collect up all the questions and then to answer them in a concluding 5 or so minutes each, so there may be rather short answers to questions, and then the total meeting will last approximately an hour. So can I ask Lord Williams of Mostyn first to introduce the subject?
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Michael says it's only 15 minutes. And mind you, for this money, I don't think you're entitled to more than 15 minutes. What we are doing is bringing about a revolution in the way this government operates and this country will work. Before 1948, people were afraid to be ill or old because there wasn't a National Health Service. And I admit its present imperfections, but the sort of change we are bringing about with this Human Rights Bill is entirely comparable to what was done in the National Health Service and its introduction in 1948. It's as dramatic as that. I do not exaggerate. After the passage of this bill into our law, nothing will ever be the same again, and much more important, nothing will ever be capable of being the same again. So this will be the first government that I can think of that willingly imposes upon itself and its successors constraints about the way that governments, public authorities can behave. We spent quite a lot of time, certainly in opposition, mainly Jack Straw, considering and consulting how we ought to incorporate the European Convention into our law. John will certainly confirm that there was an open house policy in the Home Office throughout the summer. We had endless consultations with interest groups like Liberty and came to the conclusions that we have. By and large, I think Michael is right, the argument about incorporation is long since over. One, the difficult questions were, what mechanisms would we adopt in a British context to incorporate concepts which are largely foreign to most practicing lawyers in this country, most sitting judges, and an enormous proportion of the British public. Now, we looked at other models, Hong Kong, for instance, New Zealand, Canada, and we decided to try and craft something which would be suitable for the United Kingdom and peculiarly suitable to the United Kingdom. So we tried to learn from the experience of other countries. We had to bear in mind that our culture and traditions are different. I don't say better, but they are undoubtedly different to the recent historic experience that colleagues in Germany, for instance, had. They went a different route. There isn't time to specify that, but I believe they quite rightly went a different route because their needs, dependent on their recent history, were quite different to ours. We obviously approached it looking at what we presently are and what we presently should try to become. What we presently are is a common law jurisdiction with many advances in human protections brought about by the judges. I think Michael is absolutely right to point to the work that Leslie Scarman did. It's quite a humbling experience to sit there on second reading of a bill like this and turn your head around and see on the crossbenches Leslie Scarman, ill and frail, able to travel up there to see his dream realized at last. And much more recently, one has to say, that a further kickstart was given to this debate by the present Chief Justice, Lord Bingham, at the Bar Conference in 1992, when he once again started to develop the debate. And I have to say that at that time, his words were falling, as far as practitioners were concerned, in the majority on stony ground. That's partly because of legal education over the past, before 25 years ago, when lawyers were not told about the European rights dimension at all, judges had no need to consider it, and many practitioners would not readily recognize a European point from a boiled egg. All of that now has got to change. The way that law is taught is changing. It is essential that the judges be trained, their minds opened, altered, attuned to what the problems will be that they must deal with. I have to go very, very quickly indeed, so I can only touch on a few points. We started, apart from the fact that it will be the common law tradition that will be the vehicle that will put these rights into practice for everyone, we started with the obvious point that we believe in parliamentary sovereignty. What could we have done about primary legislation? We could have allowed the judges to strike down legislation, either new legislation, existing legislation, or a combination of both. We specifically decided against that because we believe that the supremacy of Parliament is necessary to be maintained and sustained. And I believe that the judges would not themselves have welcomed powers which might have seemed draconian. How, therefore, are we to deal with a situation where primary legislation apparently conflicts with rights given under the European Convention of Human Rights? It's been dealt with, I think, in quite a subtle and peculiarly, perhaps, English way. What we have done is this, to set down a principle of interpretation so that there is an absolute binding instruction to the judges that they must construe legislation, whether existing or future, in a way, if at all possible, which is compatible with convention rights. We believe that in the majority of cases, the judges once trained and once encouraged to welcome these new concepts, will be able to deliver that sort of conclusion and consequence in most cases. What happens if that is not possible within the reasonable parameters of judicial interpretation and discretion? The alternative which we offer is that if a bill, if an act is considered by the High Court, the Court of Appeal, or the House of Lords, the tribunal at that level is able to make a declaration of incompatibility. Now, no court is going to want to do that lightly. But if a declaration of incompatibility is made by a court, High Court or above, Parliament would have to pay attention. There would be enormous moral and political pressure and academic pressure that the law should be looked at. One of the notorious deficiencies of the parliamentary system is that law reform is too slow. We have therefore introduced a brand new mechanism when the bill becomes law, which will be called the fast-track remedial measure. And that means, in a nutshell, if a declaration of incompatibility is made, the relevant minister will be able to lay an order before Parliament, subject to some time safeguards. Parliament will, within 60 days, be offered the opportunity of remedying, by the fast-track order, the particular part of the offending statute. Completely new in our law, something that we thought was a better way forward in the English, Welsh and Scottish and Northern Ireland context than simply giving the judges to strike down primary legislation, which, as I said earlier, they did not want. It is more subtle than that, however. The headline in the election literature was bringing rights home. In other words, the rather crude statement, crude but true, that you won't have to wait 5 or 6 years to go to Strasbourg with all the expense, the uncertainty and the delay. You can have your remedies in the domestic jurisdiction. That is true, but it is only the crudest statement of the purpose. The real purpose is infinitely more subtle than that. What we are looking for is the osmotic process by which the ideas, the concepts of human rights will introduce themselves into the political process, the legislative process, and the administrative and executive process in this country. So it's quite an effort. If this government does nothing, and that's not right because we've done quite a lot already, if it did nothing but introduce this, it could retire happy, content, and garlanded with laurels. Whitehall is going to wholly change the way it operates. How do we do that? We believe in concepts, of course, but we believe in structures and mechanisms. What is the structure and mechanism that is going to bite on government? A simple step, extremely important. When a bill is introduced, there is a responsible minister who does it. At the moment, he has to sign a financial memorandum about financial costs and so forth. When this bill becomes law, any relevant minister introducing a new bill into Parliament has got to put his fingerprint to this proposition that he believes that the new bill is either compatible with the European Convention or it is not. That as a discipline will produce enormous consequences, because virtually no minister will want to go to either House of Parliament to say, I am willfully introducing a non-convention compliant bill. That's an extraordinary discipline at the first stage, and I would find it very difficult to contemplate, except in the most extreme circumstances, any minister wanting to put his head on the line and say, I know that this bill is non-compliant. That's the grander scheme. What about, I hear you cry, the Magistrates' Court in Swansea? The answer to that is this. Every court, however low, that's the Magistrates' Court, the Crown Court, the County Court, will have to take into account principles of European Convention, not in the grand sense of being able to say this act is not compatible, but where any submission is made on behalf of any defendant, they will have to bear into account, take into account, the rights which are delivered by this bill. Just the crudest, shortest of examples, because I'm already almost running out of time. There may be the possibility of a defendant saying, with added force, you have infringed my right to a fair trial within reasonable time limits. You have not disclosed documents. You have not given me full particulars. You haven't given me lists of witnesses. Anyway, you knew all these facts 18 months ago and you only charged me last night. Now, all of those points are capable of being deployed at the moment on the abuse of process argument, but they are going to be given an extra plasma injection, because any defendant or any participant in any case is going to be able to say in any court in the land or any tribunal, these are my rights. I wish them to be reflected, fully reflected, in any submission I make to you at any stage of the trial. Now, that means an enormous amount of training has got to be done. Marcel Berlin says that not enough money has been devoted, and that may well be right. And it may be that we'll have to consider using the money that is available for designated judges in the same way that one has designated judges now to try cases under the Children Act, or designated judges to do rape or particular offences of child abuse. That's only a thought that I'm putting forward in response to Marcel's reasonable point that perhaps we haven't got enough resource to do all the training at the same time. That's government. We say that all public authorities have an obligation under the Act to behave convention compatibly. What's a public authority? We thought about having a list, we decided against it. The human right to free expression, as you see, is necessarily dependent on other circumstances. So I've got 3 minutes, so I've got to be very quick indeed. What's a public authority? We thought about having a list. We thought that would be too inflexible and it would not be susceptible to changing conditions. What we therefore said was public authorities fall into two categories. One is the elephant standing on your doorstep, the police, the government, government departments, the CPS, people who are, or organizations which are plainly in that category. There are others which fall into a dual mode. Railtrack as an example. It's the statutory safety regulator, but it is a commercial organization. When Railtrack is a public authority in terms of function, it will have to behave convention compliant. That means that a single individual will be able to sue a public authority for acting in breach of the individual's convention rights. That is why I suggest that this is a complete revolution about the way we go about things. Every organization which is a public authority is going to have to do the job that sensible organizations, even academic institutions, formerly had to do when equal opportunities came in, proper industrial tribunal rights came in. Every organization is going to have to say to itself, are my internal structures bomb-proof in convention terms? That is why I say that we are on the edge of a revolution. Now, all of these things are so extraordinarily exciting that it is going to be possible for someone in about 5 years' time to be writing his or her master's thesis or doctorate, looking back at 1998, February, thinking, good God, we didn't even have a Human Rights Act at that time, in the same way that people now say, good God, before 1948, there wasn't even a National Health Service. That's a very brief review of an enormous panorama, and it's a real privilege, first to be here, but even more, to be with any sort of breathing distance of a bill like this.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for inviting me. I'm always privileged to come to this place again, having been a student many years ago, a student of sociology then, and things have moved on for me, and I think things are moving on with this new government. The first thing I need to say is a little advertisement. Liberty, the National Council for Civil Liberties, is a membership organisation. We can only do our bit if you do your bit. If you aren't members of the National Council for Civil Liberties, please see me afterwards. You have no rights to avoid seeing me, and the sanctions will be very considerable. This is a very important measure, the incorporation of the European Convention on Human Rights. The government has got a lot of it has put it in the context of ensuring that rights will be exercisable, that people will have real rights, that public authorities will have real duties, and for that I congratulate them. It's also true that the process has worked well. I'm afraid to say I and my colleagues and other organisations have been boring Gareth and other ministers during the summer and since that time with our views about what they should do. For the first time in at least the years that I've been at Liberty, we had a government that was much more interested in listening to our views. Not because of anything about Liberty and the Labour Party, but because they came to the government with a view that there should be protections for human rights. I'm not suggesting in any way that they got it all right, and I'm afraid to say I'm going to be talking briefly about some of the things where I think perhaps they could have got it a bit better. But I think that this is important, and it's important that they listened, and I think, although we'll have to wait a few years to see all of the minutes of all the cabinet meetings, I think that we and others had an influence in changing their minds during the summer and improving the bill. Gareth, Michael has already said that it wasn't always Liberty's policy to support a Bill of Rights and the incorporation of the European Convention, and it wasn't Labour Party's policy. We did have a role in changing their view, and that's an important development. What this bill will be is fundamental, because it will overturn common law in relation to areas of human rights. It will overturn secondary legislation in relation to issues of human rights. It will apply to all courts and tribunals. The definition of public authority in the bill for those students of judicial review, in my view, is wider than the judicial review test. So more public authorities will be subject to the European Convention than are subject to judicial review, and I'm sure that there will be a development in the law in that direction. There are wide remedies. There are the process of declarations of incompatibility, and there is a fast-track procedure for getting the law right when the courts have declared that it doesn't comply with the convention. So those are all very, very good things. It is, however, only a first step. The European Convention on Human Rights is 50 years old. We should have incorporated it, perhaps, on the day that we gave people the right to take their cases to Strasbourg. That's in 1966. And of course it's important that we've done it now, but I think if we'd have done it then, perhaps the convention would have been incorporated and be part of our domestic law. The convention is old, so therefore it has a lot of rights which are missing, which most people today would accept should be part of a Bill of Rights. The discrimination provision, for instance, is inadequate and only applies in relation to other rights already contained in the convention. There's no freedom of information provision. Now, of course, the government has already produced their Freedom of Information white paper, and there will, I'm sure, be an act, and that will be important, but it won't be part of a Bill of Rights. There are, of course, many, many other missing rights, and some of the limitations in the convention are perhaps out of date too. So we'd like to see this government move from this place, from the first step of incorporating the convention, to some process of consulting the people of this country on developing a Bill of Rights. I'm not suggesting that we, Liberty, have all the answers, though in fact we have drafted our own Bill of Rights. But nevertheless, I think it's important to have a process, have a consultation process. That might take 2 or 3 years, and it will be worth seeing the extent to which one could get consensus on that. One of the steps that the government could have taken in that direction, of course, would be to incorporate not just the European Convention itself, but the protocols that have been developed since the convention was drafted. There are a number of protocols which give particularly new and important rights, such as the freedom of movement, such as other rights for people who are subject to immigration and asylum procedures. The other thing that we're disappointed about is the absence of a Human Rights Commission. The provisions in the bill, the provisions of the convention, will have a very, very significant impact. Local authorities, police officers, government departments, anybody with a public function will have to comply with the bill. But for large numbers of people out there, and even for some of the people that are in here, getting access to what the convention means will be a difficult process. They won't be able to afford lawyers, or lawyers themselves, up to date at least, won't know very much about what the convention means. What we need is a body to promote human rights, a body that will be able to promote the ideas of human rights, be able to produce public education, and of course, in some circumstances, provide detailed advice to individuals, and perhaps even as the EOC, the Equal Opportunities Commission, and then the Commission for Racial Equality, actually provide funding for litigation to take the test cases that perhaps won't be taken if that organisation isn't there. The government hasn't closed its mind to a Human Rights Commission, and I hope that we can continue to encourage them to set one up. But that will be an important development. The other issue that Gareth has already touched on, of course, is the issue of statutory interpretation, the extent to which the rights in the European Convention will trump the statutes that we've already enacted. There are two issues in relation to this, and it's complex, and I'm not going to give you a lecture for the next half an hour on it. But the first issue is whether old legislation that perhaps didn't take into account European Convention rights, where politicians perhaps weren't aware of what the meanings of some of the conventions were, and some of the issues where rights were taken away unintentionally, and there is a long list of those. In those circumstances, any other bill would have probably impliedly repealed those old acts. The doctrine of implied repeal means that new acts trump old acts. Slightly more complicated than that, but generally speaking, that's the law. In this bill, they haven't allowed that to happen. So some of the provisions that we've been concerned about in the past, for instance, the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, which not only abolished the right to silence but and restricted bail and restricted freedom of expression and particularly freedom of assembly, and in fact also took away the right to strike of the prison officers, which you may have seen if you've been reading the press recently, they've been complaining about. It was a very draconian measure, and in many cases, the Labour Party in opposition were opposed to that. I'd like to see judges being able to look at particular examples and say, where there's a breach of the European Convention, we can disapply this statute in these circumstances. Not strike down the whole act, just disapply it where there's a breach of the Convention. The government has decided that that's a violation of the principle of parliamentary sovereignty. In my view, it isn't. There are many other countries, Canada particularly, where it works perfectly well. There's a separate issue, of course, of what you do about subsequent statute. And perhaps the arguments might be slightly different in relation to that. So those are important changes that I'd like to see the government make. I think the difficulty is that the bill has got through the House of Lords, and we're not going to be successful with some of those things. There are some detailed changes that I'd like to see. I'd like to see organisations like Liberty, Justice, the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants and others have the right to take action under the bill. At the moment, if an organisation wishes to take proceedings in judicial review, it can usually develop the locus, the standing, to take a case. Under the bill, we won't be able to take those cases under the convention because of the victim test in Clause 7. In the absence of a Human Rights Commission, I think that's a development and an improvement that could be made. And I hope tomorrow, when the bill is debated, that the amendments put down by Lord Leicester and others will be accepted by the government. I'm afraid to say I'm not too optimistic. Other issues where the government have changed their mind, of course, are on damages. There was a ban on damages from cases where the court has got it wrong. Now the government has changed its mind on that as a result of pressure from us and others. So the government is a listening government. There are some things that it could listen a bit harder to. Thanks very much.
Now the floor is open. Could you, when you want to make a point, introduce yourself, who you are, what you do, and speak as clearly as possible, because there's an audience both up and down, and we'd like both to hear. I'll repeat the question if necessary, or the comment. And could everyone keep their remarks brief, please, so as to allow the maximum number of people to participate? So who would like to kick off? Yes, you, sir. Right, thank you. Yes, you, sir. I'm wondering whether will the Church of England be counted as a public authority? Right. Lord Williams will deal with that. Yes, Professor Harlow. Yes. You, sir. A definition, will there be a definition of human, as in human rights? Right, I think, yes. Yes. How will the judges be trained? Right. Yes, who is him? The clash of rights, a very important question. Yes. Yes. And the government then refuses to act, what are the consequences? And in particular, will that non-decision or decision to not to act itself be judicially reviewable? Right. Yes. How will the updating process take place? Yes. Devolution. I'm going to give Lord Williams an opportunity of dealing with these questions. It seems to me that they're pretty meaty stuff, and I think let's take these to be going on with for a moment.
Will there be legal aid? What the Lord Chancellor is looking at the moment is to have a ring-fenced fund which will be available certainly for cases which are of general public importance or general public interest in the wider sense. The final decision about legal aid hasn't been worked out, but that is a pretty firm commitment, which was the recommendation by Peter Middleton. Is the Church of England going to be a public authority? Yes. They have made a determined effort to be exempt. That was defeated by 11 votes last time round. I believe that they intend to return to it tomorrow and hope to succeed, but we would not be intent on allowing them to succeed, and if they succeed in the Lords, I think we would try to overturn it in the Commons. Fast track. At the moment, still a degree of consultation going on about that. A question of whether or not a minister ought to have a full explanatory memorandum as to why the remedy is needed and why the remedy is needed in that form. And one would expect, of course, consultation during the period. The periods have been variously suggested at 40 days to 60 days, being extended to 60 days, really to meet the consultation point. Which precise committee, not yet decided, because it's not gone through Commons yet. Is human going to be defined? No. Training of judges, it is going to be difficult, as I mentioned in respect of Marcel's point earlier. But of course these problems, on a lesser basis, have already had to be grappled with. The Judicial Studies Board, which I believe is under-resourced but does an extremely good job of work, has had to do training, for instance, in the past, when the Police and Criminal Evidence Act came in, a completely new concept in the criminal courts. There was a specific roadshow under the Children's Act to treat judges dealing with these very difficult questions. So it's going to be a difficult job. There's £5 million of public money being set aside for it, and obviously the Magistrates Association are going to have to do their own training as well. So no one overlooks the difficulties. I have to run on from there. Will the decision by a minister not to use fast-track the Judicial Review Board? No. How will the bill be updated? Well, it hasn't even become an act yet, but one of the things that we would be looking to deal with John's point about why isn't there a Human Rights Commission, is that we've already said quite plainly, we would hope there would be a Human Rights Committee in the Commons, possibly a joint human rights committee for Commons and Lords, and we would think their work would be obviously to review operation periodically, not in the first 5 minutes, but after the first 2 years, shall we say. Their function would be, if they wished, to take evidence around and about the country, to disprove the suggestion that England, that London is the centre of the discovered world. They ought to go around and about the country to do that, to propagandise and so forth. Obviously, in the devolution context, human rights will be very important, and legislation to be passed by the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Assembly by and large having no such power, will be capable of being struck down as incompatible with the Convention. Those are all the questions that I wrote down.
Excellent. On we go. Yes, you, sir. Why are you afraid? Don't be apologetic. The caseload problem. Will there be a huge increase in cases coming before the courts, right? Yes, you. How will the English judges be able to cope? Professor Barker. I think everyone heard that, yes? Retrospective effect. Yes, you, sir. Right, yes, you. Will the government put money into the information, into the process of informing the public, or will it be left to other organisations to do that in the absence of a commission to do it? Right, yes. Yes, Susan. To what extent will the Strasbourg machinery, it's actually being transformed at the moment, to what extent will the Strasbourg machinery still be in place, able to act, with particular reference to discrimination, is that right? Yeah. Yes. Can public authorities, as defendants, appeal to Strasbourg? Right, yes. At the back. Will there be any relief, and if not, if you get a declaration of incompatibility, will there be any relief, and if not, is that satisfactory? Last question before we ask Lord Williams and John Wadham, incidentally, if he wants to comment, to take this batch of questions. Oh yes, conflicting rights was not addressed.
I reminded myself I'd written down clashes, couldn't read my writing, and I was going to come back to it. Clashes, obviously, there's not going to, the answer is found, I think, internally in any article you like to look at. For instance, Article 8, rights of respect for private
is
family.
Is this microphone work?
Sorry. Shall I shout out a bit more then? The answer is found internally in many of the articles. Article 8, for instance, right to respect for privacy and family life. But Article 8.2 says there shan't be any interference with that by a public authority, except as in accordance with the law necessary in a democratic society. I omit quite a few sentences. Or for the protection of the rights and freedoms of others. And I don't think that the courts are going to find it conceptually difficult to do that, though obviously as case law develops, some strands will be seen, but it's going to be the balancing that is part, I think, of the useful tradition of the common law that I mentioned when we started off. I'm very sorry I missed the clash point, but it was my own handwriting. Caseload. We think that on the basis of the experience perhaps in Canada and elsewhere, that most of the points will be taken as part and parcel of the ordinary criminal cases. So they won't be new cases, but there will be European points taken in criminal cases. That's where the majority will be. Will the judges be able to cope? The fact is that I don't think the Court of Appeal has ever been better staffed, nor the House of Lords, substantially due to the efforts of the last Lord Chancellor, James Mackay. So I don't think that we need have any worry about the judges. If you see who's been putting forward the argument, apart from Lord Bingham, Lord Wolfe, Lord Brown Wilkinson, Lord Hoffman, I mean, all human life is there. I don't think they're going to have any problems at all. There will be problems at the lower level, but there are problems with every useful reform. So we must get on with it, train them properly, try and get appeals done quickly, maybe give priority to this class of appeal, to the Court of Appeal. Those are internal management things which I don't think should be impossible to deal with. Will religion be defined? The one thing no one's ever found a decent definition of is religion. My cult is your religion and vice versa. The victim test was John's question, so I won't answer that one. Although I can if you want me to. The CRE and the dissemination of information, we think essentially we need to look at what happens when the bill becomes an act. And we believe we ought to leave it to Parliament to decide. First of all, do they want a human rights committee? Second, should it be a joint committee of both houses? And thirdly, what sort of resource they want to put, a various source, not just financial resources. I do agree entirely with a number of observations. Public education is going to be extremely important, just as judicial education and education for politicians as well. What's the benefit of someone who gets a declaration of incompatibility? The government will, in appropriate cases, certainly consider, if it's necessary, because it won't always be, ex gratia payments. We will consider that. But in many cases, the declaration of incompatibility may be a sufficient remedy, followed by the fast track procedure. John's going to deal with why public authorities will or will not be able to appeal.
Just a few points. Firstly, in relation to declarations of incompatibility, we were trying to promote amendments to ensure that there was some process of review by the courts of ministers. It is very difficult once the philosophy of the bill has been constructed to suggest that the court should intervene in the parliamentary process, and those people who read their constitutional law will see the difficulties from the history of that. Though we think it is possible, there could be time limits. More importantly, of course, there could be a duty. But of course, that again goes back to the problem with the act as a whole. The same thing, we're trying to do the same thing with damages and other remedies for those people who have been subjected to the process of a declaration of incompatibility. Imagine, for instance, I'm not sure how often this will happen, imagine that you are convicted and the Court of Appeal says, well, your conviction should stand, but it's a breach of your human rights and you should stay in prison. I mean, and there's nothing we can do about it. I hope that those examples won't occur, but I'm afraid to say they will occur even if very rarely. So we'd like to see some remedy process, not just in relation to damages, but in relation to bail too. In relation to the updating, and one of the solutions, of course, is the protocol. The way that the convention is updated is that the 40 countries of Europe get together and decide there should be new rights, and they draft a new protocol. Of course, getting 40 countries to agree is very difficult. That's how it could be updated. in relation to whether or not the judges in this country will be able to develop the jurisprudence as it is a living instrument. I'm sure that they will. There is considerable jurisprudence already. There's a textbook which is about 750 pages long. The judges in this country are obviously starting from a long way back, and they've got to learn that jurisprudence first. Of course, public authorities don't have the right to appeal to Strasbourg, because Strasbourg is about is the last ditch process of protecting human rights. It's not about public authorities. Of course, public authorities will have a right to appeal to the House of Lords, but finally, the individual will have their own right to appeal, and there's no way in which the courts in Strasbourg can give people the right to appeal. It is possible for there to be an advisory declaration. But that's been very, very rarely used. Just a point on religious discrimination, there are the court in Strasbourg has tried to come up with some definitions in its case law. I'm not suggesting I have that to hand, but it has tried to distinguish between proper religions and cults, wherever you draw the line. I think the Strasbourg court will be persuasive in relation to the courts in this country, because of course individuals will have a right of appeal, a right to take their cases to the Strasbourg court. And of course, once it's clear that the House of Lords has got it wrong, then in future the House of Lords is going to look much more carefully. I don't know how often they will get it wrong. They've got it wrong fairly regularly in the past, but that's because they haven't had the ability to look at the convention. There should be more money for education. I think that probably there's a couple of things which I can't read, which I've written down, so I'm probably
I think I'm going to ask you Justice your question, which I apologise about persuasive as opposed to take account of. We had the argument about this, and an amendment was put down. You prefer to take account of because of, first of all, the sort of philosophic basis. We want United Kingdom remedies in the United Kingdom context. Not all the judges in Strasbourg would be entirely familiar with the way that we do things, and many of the new judges will not. So we decided in the end, particularly as many of the cases are very old now, that we would look to take account of, and specifically on damages. Clause 8 tells the courts that they have to take into account the principles that Strasbourg adopts, so the damages levels would be lower, typically, if granted at all, than the courts would look to here. I'm so sorry, the other question.
Does anybody feel that their question already put has not, in fact, been mentioned in reply? I think perhaps you might say a word just in elaboration about Strasbourg machinery still being available. I think John Wadham has already covered that, but do you want to add anything at all?
No.
Fine. Yeah, but the answer is no. There will not be any definition. That was mentioned by Lord Moss, Lord Williams.
One particular thing, Michael, in relation to that. Our position is this, and people might have different views. First of all, I think human beings have human rights, and companies don't. Under the bill, as under the Strasbourg procedure, companies have human rights. I'm afraid to say that's never been a convincing argument. Of course, there may be arguments about journalists and newspapers, trade unions and trade union individuals, but companies don't have human rights. Can't see how they could. I thought that was the second part of my answer. The Strasbourg jurisprudence says no, that in general, that when the case involved a man trying to stop the termination of his child, I think his girlfriend and he had split up, and he tried to go to Strasbourg to say, on behalf of the fetus, to say that fetus had a right to life. The commission decided that case was inadmissible, so we don't have any very clear reasons for that, but it looks like that would be their view on any other case. Now, whether our judges took a different view is difficult to say, but I think generally they wouldn't. I think they would follow the Strasbourg jurisprudence and leave it for Parliament to make those decisions. I don't think the court would want to intervene in those kinds of cases.
A last round of questions. Yes.
Thank you, Barrister. I've got some concerns about affordability, which I hope Lord Williams will be able to allay. concerns are that there will be rights for the well-off. There will be something of a gamble for the impecunious, the gypsies, the asylum seekers, and so on. The presence of someone goes to Strasbourg, no risk nor the cost against them if they lose. And they have a fair chance of getting lawyers back for their money pro bono, or for conditional fees out of first of all, what will happen if the litigant loses? Will they be liable for a large order of costs against them in a way in which the litigant who takes the European Union point and loses is now liable? And secondly, is Lord Williams able to allay my fears to bring them funds for at the end of the fight enough to meet the need, to put another way round, is some way you can assure us this threat brings them funds obviously being administered indirectly by the government, to ensure that there's enough money to take it from the government and other public bodies.
Thank you. Yes. Okay, thank you. Professor Hallow, yes. Any more questions? So?
Well, the clash of rights is going to be difficult, but it's the sort of difficult decision that judges regularly have to make every day when they're acting judicially, and that's what they're there for. So nobody pretends that either a clash between one article and another is going to be easy, or the internal sub-clash within an article is going to be easy, but that's what judges are there for. And they're going to be difficult, but I've got every confidence that they will manage. Now, on the question of money, what the Lord Chancellor has said is that he is looking to a ring-fenced fund for the sort of public interest case that I mentioned. There is no problem at all, despite the victim test, which includes potential victims. There's no difficulty at all in a human rights organization, in a particular interest organization, funding a litigant. Will they be liable for costs? Yes. And that's a matter for the court's discretion. And it may well be that they would want to temper the wind to the shorn lamb in this particular class of case, but they will certainly be liable for costs. You mentioned asylum seekers. Even before this bill came in, of course, as you know, in national security asylum cases, because of the decision in Europe in Chahal, we immediately introduced an asylum right of appeal bill, which has now become law, within a very short time of Chahal's case. There are going to be difficulties about money. There's nothing to stop lawyers acting pro bono if they wish, and there's nothing to stop them acting on a conditional fee basis if they wish. I don't pretend those are perfect answers any more than I pretend they're perfect answers in other classes of case. But at least we have goodwill towards this concept of this type of litigation. We wouldn't have gone to all this trouble and trouble for ourselves in the future, because we know it will be burdens on government, rightly adopted. I can't give you a perfect answer. That's because I'm not really a politician.
If I could, I think in relation to the clash of rights, I think the court in Strasbourg haven't always given us the guidance that perhaps our courts will need. I say that as a disappointing litigant. I represent the people who were the sadomasochist lot, the what we call the spanner case, the people who were involved in doing unpleasant things to each other for sexual pleasure, called Brown in this country, and it's called Lasky in Strasbourg. The courts in Strasbourg did a worse job, in my view, than the House of Lords did on that. At least we had a 2-3 result. We had a 7-0 result, or 9-0, I think it was, in Strasbourg. So don't play away, I say. But so there are some real issues about whether human rights is really getting to grips with it, and I think that's to do with the judges as well as to do with the convention. So therefore, I don't know the answer to your question, Cal. In relation to religious discrimination, one of the problems I mentioned when I talked when I started was that the convention is an inadequate solution to the whole of all of our human rights issues and problems. And the reason it is inadequate is that Article 14, which is the anti-discrimination provision, only applies in relation to the other rights under the convention. So, once the bill is an act and the act is part of our law, what will happen is that if you are discriminated against on religious grounds in relation to some other rights, such as, I don't know, supposing the government were to put a group of religious, impose some conditions on a particular religious group by putting them in prison, which would be contrary to Article 5, then of course the discrimination article in Article 14 would apply. But if it's about discrimination in relation to in relation to services or discrimination in relation to employment, then it doesn't apply because it's not a self-standing discrimination provision. There is, in addition to Article 14 on discrimination in general, in Article 9 there is a right to freedom of conscience, right to freedom of religious belief. There may be circumstances in which the combination of those will protect some religious groups, perhaps where local authorities are imposing planning rules on temples. There was a case particularly that I have in mind in, I think, Milton Keynes or somewhere, a Hindu temple. So there may be issues in relation to that, but I don't think that it's going to introduce religious discrimination generally. In relation to affordability, I mean, the issue is final costs. I mean, we are obviously discussing with the government the ideas of the in relation to the public interest fund, and Liberty would want to benefit from that in terms of taking cases. But I don't think we have anywhere near enough resources to do all of the public interest cases that exist. I'm not convinced that that private practice is always the best way of providing services. And then, I mean, I'm afraid to say, when I was in private practice, legal aid was used in some circumstances, neighbour disputes, a classic example, where it was pointless. I mean, there was no resolution, it was just a waste of money. But generally speaking, private practice does provide good service with legal aid, and I believe that legal aid should be extended and not cut back. But I don't think that's not the government's intention, and it's not because they don't believe in human rights, but because they have a financial imperative, which is to stick to the Tories' budget. Now, whether you think that's a good or bad thing, that's their problem.
And of course, it may be that that if there were a parliamentary human rights committee, I know people yawn when you mention a Commons committee, but if you look at what's happened this year, for instance, with Chris Mullins' committee, first-rate report on the police, delivered very, very quickly, substantially accepted. I mean, they might want to think of developing a human rights commission. There's the question of its relationship with the existing commissions, with their present expertise, whether there should be an umbrella organisation, and whether there should be funding. I mean, we haven't got the answer at the moment, because we're really starting on a very long journey indeed.
Can I thank on your behalf our two speakers? We have had the privilege of hearing from two of the leading experts in the country on this extraordinarily important, interesting and exciting development. We've been privileged to have their conversation. I must say, if I may, that the people who participated from the audience have played a major part in the evening by contributing good questions, which were brief and to the point, and that we've had a very large number of questions, I think, very well answered. So may I thank all of us, but particularly our speakers.